back to the realities of the times and problems. But for a while he finds his escape. And what does he escape from? What does all mysticism imply that we must escape from? The answer, of course, is that we must escape from ourselves as directive beings. We must escape from the peculiar tyranny of self-purpose over action. We must escape from the tyranny of the burden with which we afflict our own faculties. We must escape the weight of our own attitudes. We must escape the ponderous procedures by which we complicate every situation in life and change what might be a natural and pleasant pattern into an unendurable complex of circumstances. Thus, mysticism and its arts in our way of life reveals to us clearly that we only have to let go, that we only have to redirect our attitudes or our activities, and immediately we are free from the burden of our own prejudices and opinions and attitudes and pressures. We are free from our own historical selves, from our own oriented personalities in time and space. We become universal. We become all appreciation and no criticism. And this state in itself is one greatly to be admired. We become infused also with new things and new values. We escape the boundaries of previous imagination, and we are constantly enriching an interior storehouse of recollections which we can call upon at various times. Out of this filing system of remembrances, new personality developments arise within our own consciousness. We grow and enrich through these experiences by which we escape from self and become spectators of greater things. This is again, of course, how mysticism has moved into our present mode of existence. The movement continues, and now we find mysticism moving more and more directly into our homes. A few years ago, if you will remember, the city of Los Angeles went on the great spree of uprooting anything that looked green or alive. We found street after street completely denuded of every tree and every bush in order that we might have the fine, clean, inspiring line of solid concrete. Now the city is suddenly realizing that thousands and millions of tourists from all over the world can see concrete at home without coming here at comparatively high vacation rates. So now we have gone on the great tree planting experiment. Down the middle of Wilshire Boulevard, there are palms appearing that would do credit to the center of the Sahara Desert. Everywhere, vegetation is crawling up the front of mortgage and loan companies, perhaps to give a certain festive luxuriance to the interest rates. In any event, foliage is back. It is back because everyone got very tired of modern architecture. And as the great eccentric of architecture, Frank Lloyd Wright, observed a short time before his death, that it would be an excellent thing if people planted trees in front of every building except the ones he built, because all the others ought to be concealed in some way. Actually, there is a little apology in this tree planting epidemic. We're getting very tired of this fine, clean line, and we remember that the United Nations building in New York, for example, looks surprisingly like that 50-pound block of ice that the Iceman used to deliver. These clean, cold, dead lines are not quite as happy as we thought they were going to be. They were greatly heralded, not because anybody really liked them, but that it was a cheaper way to build and the individual could pay just as much and get less. This type of thing led inevitably in our way of life, in which art has become too heavy a luxury for most people to bear. To meet this, we have tried to bring life back into the city. We do this because we want to bring life back into ourselves. We want to recognize nature as a symbol of life. And we instinctively realize that from his conduct over the past, man has become associated as a symbol of death. Thus, man, to redeem his own works, seeks to make them live. And he ornaments them with symbols of life. And of all symbols of life, the tree is one of the most ancient. And the tree of life is deep in the subconscious of human consciousness. In any event, we observe mysticism moving back as an instinct into the private life of the citizen through the development of beauty, wherever he can find ways of cultivating this quality. And to meet this need, we have a tremendous increase in the development of decorative arts of all kinds. We find the person recognizing the importance of art in his home, the importance of art in his business. Today you will find great works of art in the lobbies of hotels. They are put there because people want them. And because if the hotel has them, more people will come and stay at the hotel. It is no philanthropy, but it is a discovery. It is a discovery that if you want people, you have to please them. And if you please them, you must do for them things which give them a sense of greater belonging, a sense of greater personal satisfaction, peace, and security in themselves. Where such factors are ignored in the private life of the individual, the difficulty is as real as it is in business institutions and public buildings. We have come back to the need for proper artistry. And in every home, and even in the most humble apartment, the individual of today is seeking mystical satisfaction or mystical security through surrounding himself with small but select groups of material that satisfy his soul. Food for the soul. And food for the soul comes from pure and true beauty. And beauty, in turn, is something that can be known only by mystical apperception. There is no absolute and unchanging rule of beauty for the individual. Beauty is that to which his own soul responds. And it is important if that part of his soul, which is essentially true, responds. It is not enough to satisfy his selfishness or cater to his delinquencies. True beauty must have meaning, must have a wonderful, subtle teachment by which the person is assisted to restore his own internal integration. So we observe every time you go into shops and stores today that while there is a mass of bric-a-brac-ery that does not mean very much, there is an increasing emphasis upon worthwhile artistic creativity. Better things along art lines are available now than for a long time. Also, we have had quite a development of what are called museum replicas of works of art. Today, a great many persons unable to own great examples of Egyptian, Greek, Oriental, or primitive American art have found that there is a certain general satisfaction in an accurate and trustworthy replica, one which can be secured for a comparatively small sum, the original beyond price. And that this reasonable facsimile can become an ornamentation or decoration in a well-appointed home and add dignity and depth of meaning to that home. So this is another example of the arising of artistry as a mystical concept in the life of the person. He is demanding more and more soul satisfaction to keep him going under the pressure and tension of his time. Nor is it false to affirm that in this present generation also, there has been considerable restoration of mystical elements in religion. For a long time, religion was the custodian of arts. And your great cathedrals of ancient and medieval Europe are also museums. And of the artistry which they preserve, perhaps some of the finest is in the stained glass and in the great artistry of the Gothic spans of the cathedrals themselves. These great temples were not only places of worship, but shrines of beauty, so far as the skill of man was able to impart beauty. And this beauty had a particular integrity because it arose from devotion and was for the most part a gift or offering of the master craftsman to the great architect of all things. More lately, we have seen a general deterioration of these values, and we have observed the surprising and disappointing lack of religious creative artistry. We have seen our Christian art deteriorate to a group of rather highly conventionalized representations, which differ but slightly in execution, though done by 100 artists. We see the general lack of great religious art in these institutions. And up to very recently, there was a surprising lack of good music in most of them. It usually required a very large and prosperous church to have an adequate choir or proper soloists. Now, music is returning strongly to the church. It is also coming back with better music, with greater emphasis upon important religious composition. For a long time, we had very little religious music being composed. More is now coming, and some of the new works are admirable, remarkable, and valuable. Also, we are observing greater attention to what might be termed the various mystical prerogatives of religion. We see greater emphasis upon the development of mystical veneration in even the most severe Protestant denominations. We see the advance of a ministry of faith healing. We see emphasis upon religious counseling. We also observe a tendency on the part of progressive ministers to change from the practice of 20 years ago, in which sermons verged resolutely into politics. And now we find them moving back again into a more liberal, but at the same time, more essentially religious field. Thus religion, faced with the weight of its own membership, and perceiving or sensing that this membership is heavily neurotic, that the pressure of circumstances are forcing the individual to seek spiritual consolation of a valid nature. These discoveries are influencing practically every religious denomination, causing the churches to work more and more to create centers of spiritual orientation rather than merely meeting places. The progress is observed, and there are a number of publications devoted to this, some of which I see, and all of them are emphasizing the importance of religious mysticism. Through the sectarianism of religion also, we see another mystical light beginning to break, and this is the light of symbolic interpretation. The old literalisms of theology are disappearing rather rapidly. Religion is taking on a universal mystical complexion. This is important and has to a measure been forced upon the churches. But regardless of how it comes about, it is helpful. One of the reasons it has come, undoubtedly, is this global strategy which we are developing psychologically. For the first time, the Western world is receiving something of the impact of Eastern culture, art, and religion. The possibility of destroying these competitive institutions now appears too remote to be considered. We realize that we cannot dominate the religions of all other peoples. We cannot proclaim them to be heretical and sweep them away, nor can we ignore them. These various religions must play their part in the theater of our modern living. They must join with us in the solution of great problems. They must be given civil treatment. They must be respected for their merits and values, and can no longer be ignored or discarded. This has brought with it a crisis in Christian theology, a crisis that the past never faced, even when challenged, and that is the crisis of a world in which at least five major religions must live together, and must live together with a temperament and an attitude that is not likely to cause them to explode into mutual warfare. Also, we are beginning to realize the extreme danger of permitting sectarianism to undermine the friendships of peoples and thereby become a useful aid to belligerent or militaristic persons with dictatorial ambitions. To use man's religious prejudice as a way of controlling or enslaving him, or turning him upon his fellow man, we hope that this has happened for the last time, and modern man begins to realize that it cannot continue without ultimately disgracing and discrediting all religion. To meet this challenge, therefore, each religion has been forced to seek overtones. It has been forced to search out points of common agreement, the last thing which would have happened 200 years ago. Also, the possibility that religions are interpretations of interior spiritual values held in common by all men, such possibility is being rather carefully considered. It is becoming evident that religion as of itself is a value apart from all forms, that as a value it is a mystical truth, and also that approached mystically it can be reconciled. The mystic is perfectly able to worship in any type of religious institution without being outraged or offended.